This hour, if and where ISIS might fit into the violence in St. Cloud this weekend. 12 hours after an attacker stabbed 8 people at a St. Cloud mall and was shot and killed by an off-duty police officer, the Islamic State claimed credit for the attack. The Associated Press and NPR are reporting that ISIS called the 22-year-old attacker, quote, a soldier of the Islamic State, and pronounced it an operation against what ISIS calls the Crusader Coalition. Now, the FBI is saying it's not sure of a strong link between the attacker and ISIS and is calling it, quote, a potential act of terrorism. Today, 3 guests who can give us some insight on those claims and that language and what the implications are if indeed ISIS was involved. If you have questions about how ISIS might radicalize people outside of the Middle East or about how to understand so-called lone wolf attacks, we'll put the phone number out. We'll open Twitter. You can weigh in and ask your questions or your comments. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter with a question out at Carrie NPR. Our guest today, Bruce Hoffman, is director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown, where he's also a professor. We find him this morning in L.A., where I know it's early, Bruce, so welcome and good to have you on the show.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Bill Danvers is a former employee of the CIA and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and he's with us this morning from Washington. And Bill, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks very much. Good to talk to you again, Carrie.
John Radson's going to join us a little later from Mitchell Hamlin Law School. Bill, I want to get to ISIS's claims in a minute. I'd like your take on the way that this attack in St. Cloud was carried out. With a knife, words spoken about Allah, asking, we are told, at least one person if they were Muslim. Does that add up to anything for you?
Well, it does. It does in a sense. Number one, I think I'd like to just sort of express my sympathy to the victims and their families, both in St. Cloud and in New York City. Second thing I'd like to add, Carrie, is it's a real privilege to be on with Bruce Hoffman, who's just an absolute expert in this area, and I'm anxious to hear what he has to say as well. I think that this does potentially add up to at least an ISIS-inspired attack. Amok, the ISIS sort of news service, if you will, has laid claim to the attacker, as you said in your news segment, to be a part of the Crusader Coalition. I think the fact that he invoked Allah while he was making an attack and asked one of the victims if he was a Muslim, I think also is an indication that there may be a connection. But it doesn't, at least at this particular point, seem to be operational, but it does seem to be inspirational.
Bruce, I want to get to the difference between the operational and the inspirational here, but I also want to note that it took ISIS 12 hours to claim responsibility. If they were behind the planning, the operational side of this, would it take that long?
No, not necessarily. And ISIS, of course, is extraordinarily opportunistic, and it's going to seize on whatever incident has occurred in some corner of the world that it can possibly attach its name to. That said, though, ISIS is very selective in what it claims and what it doesn't claim. And I think this goes to Bill's point about whether something's operational or inspirational. This does not fit an ISIS profile, at least in my view, where there was some direct command and control relationship, at least based on the facts as we know them now. That could change. It seems that it was much more inspirational. And, of course, going back to September 2014 and again this past May, ISIS's now deceased chief operations officer and spokesperson, Abu Muhammad Adnani, had specifically called on ISIS's followers throughout the world to carry out precisely these types of attacks. So it fits a very broad, very general inspirational pattern. But one would be surprised if there is a direct command and control, if they actually told this person to go to this mall and actually kill these people.
So, Bruce,
to kill them.
Bruce, when you say that they are selective, is that why perhaps we are not seeing claims of responsibility for what has happened in New Jersey and New York, and we would see, and we are seeing them for St. Cloud? Is that a better way to try to understand this?
Precisely. I mean, again, they're opportunistic, but they're not completely promiscuous, if that makes sense. I mean, they'll seize upon things that they believe there is some connection with, where the individual responsible for the St. Cloud stabbings may have had some contact with ISIS radicalizers or ISIS ideologues, whereas perhaps in the case of New York, there isn't that direct connection, or at least not that we know right now.
Bill, why wouldn't ISIS just claim responsibility for every act of violence that, you know, seems in some way connected to their mission and their goals?
Well, I think, as Bruce rightly suggested, they're not promiscuous, but they are opportunistic. And they may be looking for a kind of connection between what they are trying to promote and what their agenda is and the people who are committing these acts, as opposed to just sort of doing it at random. There is a kind of coordinated effort, I think, on a part of ISIS leadership to try to take some measure of control over these kinds of occurrences. On the other hand, a lot of these occurrences are really beyond anybody's control. They really are arbitrary acts and only tangentially connected to any particular ideology, whether it be ISIS or it be a white supremacist.
So, Bruce, when you say that the leader of ISIS, this leader that you were quoting, is dead? Is dead?
Yeah.
Now, okay.
Yeah, he was killed last month in a drone strike.
How was
airstrike?
Yeah. How was his message to carry out some of these acts? I mean, how did you hear what he was asking for, and how do you think it was heard in the radicalized world?
Well, I think on multiple levels. Firstly, it was widely publicized by Amaq, ISIS's external communications arm, which Bill referred to earlier, and it was widely broadcast. But then, of course, in whatever contact these individuals might have had with radicalizers or with ISIS ideologues, they would be encouraged, bidden, influenced, motivated to actually go out and do these types of attacks. And that therein may be where the ISIS link actually lies, is that there had been some contact perhaps between this individual and someone indeed associated or affiliated with ISIS. I mean, that's very different from having a commander that's actually giving you orders and very specific instructions. But of course, this rather more, I mean, laissez-faire approach to terrorism that's inspirational and motivational more than actually operational is very much part of ISIS's DNA and what had set it apart from many other terrorist groups. And of course, if the purpose of these attacks is to instill terror, and part of that creation of a sense of fear and alarm is their unpredictability, this is why a quote-unquote soft target, tragically, like a shopping mall on a Saturday evening, is so appealing to these assailants, because you can't protect every possible target from every conceivable attack all the time.
Yeah, Bruce, you just alluded to something, though, that I wanted to get at here. You said there may not be some commander who's specifically saying, do this night and in this place, and do that night and in that place. But you said there could have been a contact between this person in St. Cloud or some of these other individuals who are interested in these kinds of acts of violence. I that contact, is that somebody potentially in our community in the United States, or is this all done digitally and it doesn't really matter where these people, these contacts might be?
I'm not sure it matters. It could be done in either fashion. It could be remotely or it could be personally. I mean, this is the problem with the type of social networks that terrorists these days attempt to prey upon and target. It could be a virtual social network or it could be an actual one. But I think your question really underscores a key point in understanding this. I think the lone wolf moniker is misleading. There are no lone wolves. I mean, these are not people who of their own volition are going to wake up one morning or decide one evening that I'm going to go out to a mall and attempt to brutally attack people. There's some degree of inspiration, motivation that ultimately triggers an animation to go and do these things. And I think as a very renowned communication specialist who studies terrorism and the internet, Gabriel Weinman, has argued that behind every lone wolf, there's a virtual pack.
So this is something that I want to also understand, Bill. And we have a question that I think goes to this from a listener. Joe asks, doesn't self-radicalization require a predisposition for being radicalized? Is there something in Islam, some teaching, that leaves people open to this type of idea? So really two questions there. The first about, can you really be truly self-radicalized, or are we talking more about what Bruce describes?
Well, I think, sure, you can be self-radicalized, but you have to have a predisposition for self-radicalization. I mean, I think in some ways, and actually, Carrie, this comes from one of your listeners from the last time I was on, in some ways to call them wolves is to kind of confer a kind of dignity on a kind of psychopathic behavior. What they really are, in effect, are killers or murderers. They're not. There is no dignity in this process. And I think, yes, you can be radicalized over time, and you can use, whether it be Islam or it be white supremacists, because I think the term lone wolf comes from a group of white supremacists or a couple of white supremacists in the 1990s. So you can use whatever ideology you want to if you have a tendency for this kind of psychopathic behavior. That's kind of how I would look at it.
So Bill, you know, that goes a bit against what I think we've experienced in Minneapolis, which is where some people, a small number of people, have been radicalized and then persuaded to leave the Twin Cities and go overseas to fight on behalf of some of these jihadist groups. Is that the kind of personality you're talking about, or is this a very different thing?
Well, I think it can be a very different thing. I mean, I think when you go out to join a fight, when you go out to join a cause, and you're part of a larger group, I think that's a very different behavior, and actually I would suggest a very different profile than someone who takes it upon themselves, whether it be working with a group on the internet or otherwise being inspired to go out and then just murder, as what occurred in St. Cloud on Saturday evening.
Bruce, what's your sense about how likely it is that we'll ever know if Dahir Adan, who was identified by his father as the attacker, radicalized himself, had the kind of personality that we're talking now, or was pretty influenced by outside people? Will we know that?
I assume from, subsequent police investigation, again, it's always in any kind of terrorist incident of this sort. It's very early days. It's very speculative before we have the complete picture. But, you know, don't forget, ISIS is actually telling its adherents or would-be sympathizers and supporters of foot soldiers actively to stay in place and carry out attacks in your homeland, especially as ISIS's caliphate is being consistently and successively eroded by military operations, as Mosul is poised to fall in the next few months and subsequently Raqqa, having already lost Sirte. So their strategy is actually right now conforms very much to the incident that we tragically saw in St. Cloud on Saturday night. So that's why I think there's probably more to this that we're not aware of yet, and that may yet be revealed.
I want to follow up, Bruce, on what you've just said about what's happening with Mosul. We know that the U.S. forces are additional U.S. forces are being deployed. It looks like the U.S. and Iraqi troops are going to move on Mosul, sometime in October. Can ISIS remain as virulent of a threat if they don't have the kind of territory that they've had in the last several years? Can they do these kinds of acts if they were behind what we saw in St. Cloud and some of these other places, if they don't have the kind of territory they possess now?
Absolutely. Their external operations arm has always been independent of their battlefield command and control. And ISIS is not going to end with the fall of a city. And it's not probably going to even end if the caliphate is completely destroyed in subsequent months. I mean, ISIS has deliberately deployed operatives, certainly across Europe. And we know that this is far more extensive than people imagined even a year ago as a result of the attacks in Paris and Brussels. And then this is precisely the problem. And then you have an incident such as in July in Nice, where it's not operatives following the direct command and control, but very much of this inspirational and motivational. So you have a two-pronged threat that I don't think is going to disappear when they lose territory. If anything, ISIS will want to stay in business. I mean, they will want to survive. You don't create a terrorist group to put yourself out of business. And this will, I think, unfortunately, be a struggle that, having planted the seeds of radicalization, of hatred, of intolerance, of the justification of violence, it's not something that's going to go away in a short period of time.
Bill, what would you say to that?
I could not agree with Bruce more. I think he absolutely makes a crucial point. While I think it is essential that we continue to destroy the caliphate, both in Iraq and Syria eventually, it will not stop ISIS from wreaking havoc, not only in the region, but internationally, and that includes here in the homeland. I think that's ISIS is in effect metastasizing. It's a word that's been kind of overused with regard to ISIS, but it happens to also be true. It's changing. It's morphing. It's changing from an organization that focused on the caliphate to one that has a more global reach, and it is becoming more operational globally and inspirational, as we saw, I think, in St. Cloud the other night. And I think we cannot miss that point if we really and truly want to defeat and diminish ISIS's ability to cause us harm and to have terrorist acts, to support terrorist acts.
If you've just tuned into the conversation this hour, we're trying to better understand some of the influences that might have been behind what we saw in St. Cloud over the weekend with the stabbing at the mall, the death of the suspect, his potential connection to ISIS, some of the things that he said during the attack. Bill Danvers, one of our guests, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and we have Bruce Hoffman for a couple more minutes here. He's director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown. John Radson joining us on the other side of news. If you have a question, questions about how ISIS might radicalize people outside of the Middle East, the operational versus inspirational element of this that we've been talking about with our guests, how to understand these individual attacks, this is a good opportunity to ask some of those questions. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Bruce, I want to come back to something that you wrote. It was on the 14th anniversary of 9/11, so last year, and you wrote this in Politico about ISIS. The cumulative effect has been that we've stood on the sidelines as a new, more pernicious hybrid threat has emerged, a threat that erodes any meaningful distinction between terrorism, insurgency, and limited conventional warfare. ISIL is something the world has never seen before. You were also quite critical of the U.S. approach to ISIS, the way that that has been undertaken. I assume you remain so.
Yes, I think, the problem is we focus on the terrorism threat du jour and have a very, I think, a tactical perspective rather than a strategic one of seeing what's coming down the pike, what the next emergent threat could be. And if I was rewriting that article today, I would say that, okay, we've marshaled our resources. ISIS is on, it's certainly on its back feet right now. We've accomplished an enormous amount in the past year, but we've also seen how pernicious and how much more significant the ISIS threat was compared to what I was writing about. And I would say the next threat coming down the pike is a revived al-Qaeda, that as we've been so preoccupied and transfixed with ISIS, al-Qaeda has been, I think, very gleefully letting ISIS absorb all the attention and absorb all the heat while it very patiently rebuilds in various places, Libya, certainly the Levant in Syria, and also in South Asia.
May I ask you real quickly about whether you hear any kind of serious policy discussion in the campaign for president about what you've just described, this revival of al-Qaeda?
No, like I said, everybody's focused on ISIS and the threat right now. And this is the problem, is that for terrorist groups to survive, they have to be strategic and they have to be constantly planning and adjusting and adapting to our countermeasures and gauging what their next steps will be. I think we need to get out in front and realize that this is a problem that has become so entrenched as an issue of international security that it's not something that's going to be easily or quickly resolved, and that it's going to constantly morph or evolve into different forms, and that we have to be better at anticipating those new forms.
Bruce, I appreciate the time. Very grateful for it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Bruce Hoffman is director of the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown. A call for you here, Bill, from Patrick in Minneapolis. Hi, Patrick. Your question for Bill Danvers.
Yeah, thanks, Carrie. My question is whether there's any way for us to disrupt ISIS's online presence by corrupting their websites. I know similar things have been tried in the past with Al-Qaeda-inspired websites, but I'm not sure if that's something that our government is actively looking into or whether that would even be counterproductive.
Bill, what do you think?
I think it's a really good question, and I don't think it would be counterproductive at all. But I think it's something that governments can do, but they need to do in conjunction with the private sector, which actually I think gives me an opportunity to answer a question that you just asked Bruce a moment ago,
mm-hmm.
Kerry, regarding campaigns getting involved with this. I know at least one of the campaigns is very involved with this kind of effort to figure out a strategy that incorporates not only what's going on with ISIS, but with Al-Qaeda, and that gets to what Patrick is driving at. How do we disrupt them on the internet? How do we disrupt them in sort of their ability to use social media as a way to inspire and to coordinate? And I think we need to do that with the private sector. I know some of that is being done with the present administration. Ash Carter, among others, has really been involved with going out to Silicon Valley and trying to use technology as a way to defend ourselves. And I believe that depending on who gets elected president, that will be certainly part and parcel of what will have to occur going forward. The dilemma with that is we want to make sure that we don't sort of undermine our personal freedoms. Our personal freedoms versus sort of our security concerns is really a kind of a balancing act that we have to strike. I believe we can do it, but I believe we have to roll up our sleeves and figure out the best way to do it so that in our concern about protecting ourselves, we don't undermine civil liberties, and in our concern about civil liberties, we don't undermine the ability for law enforcement and the intelligence community to get the job done.
And Bill, just to be clear here, since Bruce talked about the next, so we've got ISIS on its back feet, I think he said, but
yes.
Then he said the next thing we really have to worry about is the reformation or the resurgence of Al-Qaeda in some of these failed states like Libya. And you concur with that as well?
Yeah, well, absolutely, positively. I mean, I think Bruce's analysis, once again, he's really good on this, is spot on. Al-Qaeda is formidable, and we need to pay attention to it. It's been sort of off the screen because ISIS is sort of taken over in terms of the sort of the main terrorist group that we pay attention to. But Al-Qaeda has been very, very active, and I think we need to continue to sort of pay attention to Al-Qaeda and pay attention to the kind of moves that it's taking. It has a different approach than ISIS. It's certainly not as brutal, and the idea of establishing a caliphate is not something that's sort of part of ISIS's strategy. But the idea of using sort of this radical ideology as a way to inspire attacks is actually something that ISIS has been doing for years. In some ways, it's back to the future. There was a fellow by the name of Al-Awlaki who was actually born in the States, but who was kind of one of the leaders of Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula, and he used the idea of inspiration as a way to sort of disrupt the United States and Europe and other countries. And he would you could find, I think you still can find, in fact, I'm sure you can still find some of his sermons. He was an imam online that used as sort of inspiration for people to sort of attack in kind of a lone killer type way.
I think, Bill, this is something that Joby Warrick writes about in his most
Joby
recent
Warrick's
book, right?
Terrific for those who haven't read it. It's absolutely terrific.
We'll put that up online because I interviewed him about the book recently, so we'll put that up. Call here, Bill, for you from RC in St. Paul. Hi, good morning. Your question for Bill.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I was wondering, do you guys think that ISIS is a borderless nation? You know, when I think about what's going on, it seems that people who are radicalized are almost looking for a place to belong. And I wonder if ISIS is a place like they can volunteer to become a member of a nation. And normally you're born into a nation, but this is one where you can volunteer. You think that's part of what's going on?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, because I think when we sort of look at the mind of a terrorist, whether they be a lone killer or someone who wants to join a larger group, we want to sort of dig in and uncover as to why people want to belong and how they want to belong and what it is they're really trying to belong to. To call it a nation, I think that was their aspiration, ISIS's aspiration in establishing a caliphate. Maybe not a nation in any sort of traditional sort of Westphalian sense, but a nation in the sense that a caliphate. which is more than just sort of a terrorist organization attacking, where you actually administer a particular region and you've got a kind of local governance. But I don't think that they really are a nation or have the same sense of what a nation is as we do. I think I mentioned this the last time we spoke, mm-hmm. that I view ISIS more as a cult,
yes,
that is opportunistic,
that.
As opposed to having a grand strategy that it sort of follows through on and administers step by step. I think it's opportunistic. I think it has taken advantage. I think it has a sense of where it wants to go, but I think it's missing a lot of the details and tactics on how to get there.
Bill Danvers continues with us on the other side of news. John Radson joins us. I'm going to be interested in his assessment of what Bill just said about the way he views ISIS and, of course, your calls and your questions about trying to understand how ISIS might radicalize people outside of the Middle East, their mission and their goals, and what Bruce Hoffman told us a few minutes ago about the resurgence of al-Qaeda and the threat that that might present. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, where there's some good questions coming in, and I'll get to those as well. It's at Kerry NPR. But now to Phil Picardi. And Phil, I'm sure you're following the consequences of this attack in St. Cloud.
Indeed. It's all about what you're talking about, Kerry. Authorities are investigating the stabbings of 9 people at St. Cloud, Minnesota's mall, the Crossroads Mall, as a potential act of terrorism. The alleged attacker, Dahir Aden, moved to Minnesota with his father 15 years ago. Aden's father told reporters that he did not know of any possible connections his son may have had to a terrorist group. The 9 victims are recovering from their wounds. Aden was shot and killed by an off-duty police officer. New York's governor now says it looks like the Manhattan bombing could be an act of terrorism with a foreign connection. Andrew Cuomo made the statement after the New York Police Department said authorities were searching for 28-year-old Ahmad Khan Rahami in connection with the bombing. He is a naturalized citizen from Afghanistan. The bomb went off on Saturday in Manhattan's Chelsea neighborhood, injuring 29 people. All have been released from a hospital. FBI agents are searching an apartment in New Jersey that is tied to Rahami. He lived at that address in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Authorities converged on the apartment early today after one of 5 devices found at the nearby Elizabeth train station exploded. While a bomb squad robot attempted to disarm it, no one was injured in that bombing. The White House says President Obama was briefed throughout the night and early today on the investigation into bombs found in New York and New Jersey. Obama is expected to comment this afternoon. And Donald Trump says police are afraid to do anything to stop attacks like the bombing in New York because they don't want to be accused of racial profiling. In a phone interview on Fox News, the Republican presidential candidate said local police often know who a lot of these people are, but they are afraid to do anything about it because they don't want to be accused of profiling. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:34.
On our Monday All Things Considered, DFL Congressman Rick Nolan and Republican challenger Stuart Mills are preparing for their first debate of the campaign season. Their race for Congress is one of the most competitive in the country. I'm Tom Cran. Join me for that and all the day's news. I'm here weekdays starting at 3.
Hey, keep up with all of the shows that we're having when we talk about politics or books or science or big ideas. You can find it on the podcast right now on the podcast. And hearing from a lot of you on this, Grief is a Thing with Feathers, that interview that I did last Monday with Max Porter, and the Friday Roundtable on music. Took a little break from politics. It was a welcome break, and you can hear it on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Kerry Miller in iTunes.
Support for this program comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
Back to our conversation now. Bill Danvers continues with us. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. And John Radson joins us. He's a former assistant counsel at the CIA, a professor of law on security issues at Mitchell Hamlin Law School. Hi, John.
Good morning, Kerry.
Good to have you back on the show. Hey, I know you heard a bit about what Bill was saying about cult, his view of ISIS as a cult, and I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
I don't think I'll debate Bill about what word to use, and I don't know that we're going to be able to encapsulate it into one word or one metaphor. And you mentioned Joby Warwick's book, Black Flags. Even reading that book, I think it's difficult to identify all aspects of ISIS. We know that they still have territory. They're losing it. We know that they have a central command, as al-Qaeda does. What concerns me even more is this idea of a regenerating virus, that they don't necessarily need territory. They don't have to train or coordinate the attacks. But if they've put this ideology out there and these techniques, then people can latch onto it. They can cause a lot of damage and destruction. And that's something that may not be on the scale of 9/11, but it's much more difficult to detect, and it will be much more difficult to eradicate. And I think this president and the last one have reminded us that this is going to be a long conflict, a long battle, a long time with counterterrorism.
And John, when Bruce Hoffman was on, Bill and Bruce and I talked about the difference between inspirational and operational. What would you add to that?
I'd add the notion of training, and that's where we've made progress, is I don't think we have the kind of training camps that existed in Afghanistan beforehand. And I think Bruce and Bill would agree is sometimes the line between inspirational and operational gets blurred. If the pure example of inspirational, somebody that didn't have any contact, any training, and they've decided they're disgruntled, they want to cause damage, and they connect themselves to this kind of ideology. There may be somebody that at the other end was an operative, been part of the command for a long time, and then you're going to have people that fall within those two poles. So I think it's useful, and what people are saying about this attack is that it seems to be more inspirational than operational. And we notice that the governor in New York is shifting. At first, he said it didn't seem to be international terrorism. Now he's opened up that possibility.
And Bill, Rick on Twitter says, can you describe the difference between centralized and decentralized threats and effective defenses?
Well, I mean, a centralized threat, I think, is more one that is directed by the central authority. And decentralized could be a couple of different things, at least at first blush. It could be developing cells which relate to the central authority, but which also have a kind of autonomy. And it could be someone who is more self-radicalized and inspired by connections on the internet, inspired by what he or she reads, but not necessarily connected at all to a central authority, at least only tangentially. And in terms of effectiveness, well, I think both can be effective and both can be ineffective. I think oftentimes what we miss in the context of these kinds of conversations are the dogs that didn't bark, and the people that John worked with for a number of years and that I worked with for a brief period of time at the agency have done an incredible job in preventing these kinds of attacks from occurring. And we can't miss that as well.
John, you may remember when FBI Director James Comey was in town in June.
And I do.
Yeah, and he was talking about, I think, this idea of central versus decentralized radicalization at a distance. Let's listen to a bit of what he said and talk about it.
The Bureau has close to 1,000 open cases in all 50 states focused on people who are at some stage between consuming the poison from the group we call ISIL to acting on that poison, either by traveling or by moving towards violence here in the United States.
So what do you make of that, John, with how the United States needs to respond to that?
I'm concerned, I think, the way most citizens are about the number of investigations. We here in the Twin Cities know about the investigation that's going on. It started into people joining al-Shabaab, now they're joining ISIS or ISIL.
Right.
It's been summarized as the Travelers case. And I pick up on Comey's point there. That's a tipping point from inspiration to operational. If the person then travels to go fight in Syria or Iraq, travels to get training, that person has become much more of a concern. We've talked on other programs that if you can recruit somebody to become a suicide bomber, recruit them to train or fight, it doesn't take much for those operational commanders in Al-Qaeda or ISIS to figure out maybe this is somebody that they can slip back. The downside is that those people may have left some kind of marks in their phone calls, their travels. They may have tipped themselves off to the authorities. Those persons, because of their training, can do more damage, but they're going to be easier to monitor. The concern that we have with the more recent examples in the United States, these are people that have kept a low profile in terms of their cell phone, their emails. They've decided that they're going to do something very bad, and they act upon it. Think about the Boston Marathon attacks in 2013.
John, a call for you here from Patrick in New Brighton. Hey, Patrick, and thanks for waiting. What do you want to ask?
Thank you. I'm concerned because there is a context to this attack that hasn't been, I haven't heard it this time. St. Cloud is a hotbed of right-wing politics, Stearns County, that entire area. It's also an area where there have been persistent anti-Muslim attacks. Many of the students in the junior and high schools in the St. Cloud area have taken action because of racist attacks among students in school.
Mm-hmm.
There is a context to this attack, and I think we need to be aware of that. And the anti-Islam Islam movement is very strong in this particular area. So I think he was acting out of a sense of retribution, possibly. I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah. I mean, John, we don't know yet, but what would you say to that?
We don't know, and I agree with Patrick's term to suggest this is part of the context. I don't hear him talking about causation, whether it's from the right-wing groups or from American Muslims that are there. And I think he hints to an important discussion that we need to have at both levels. The community here, how are we doing in greeting people, in assimilating people that come from different countries, different religions? We don't want these attacks to serve ISIS's agenda by radicalizing more people. If we overdo our reaction by the community or in law enforcement, there may be people that weren't embittered that will become embittered. On the other hand, I wouldn't put it all on law enforcement and the general community. I think that the Somali community needs to recognize, and they have, that this is a problem that some of their young men and some young women have been drawn to this ideology, have traveled, have done things. And it is in their interest, like everybody else's interest, to remind that this is a law-abiding community like other communities. They came here fleeing problems, but they do have some people that have been drawn to this. And we need to work together to minimize the number of attacks and to prevent the possibility of a backlash. And I hope there is not a backlash that's been said by many of our political leaders here in Minnesota.
Bill, I'm really glad John brought this up because this is something I wanted to mention. You know, immediately after, or within hours, I should say, after the details of this attack came out in St. Cloud, spokespeople for the Muslim community and the Somali community came out to say our thoughts are with the victims, you know, this is not representative of the community at large. And people will say, why, you know, why aren't members of the community speaking more vociferously about, you know, this potential issue within the community and speaking out against this? I see the community often between a rock and a hard place on this. And I'd like your thoughts.
Well, it sounds like from the way you described it, Carrie, that they did speak out.
And they
and
did.
And that they wanted to make sure that they that not only the people in Minnesota, but all of us understand that this has nothing to do with the Somali community per se in St. Cloud or throughout Minnesota. It is, that said, it is important that they speak out. It is important that they differentiate between how they see their role in Minnesota, how they see their community, how they see their religion, versus people like the one who committed the act of violence on Saturday night. And again, that gets back to my point about calling them a sect as opposed to calling them sort of part of a main part of mainstream Islam. I think they are separate from that. I think they are not part of the mainstream community. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the community doesn't need to sort of make that point as well and differentiate. I think it's important because I think what we need to do is work together and to not alienate. And if the community doesn't speak out vociferously, then that gives people an opportunity to, an unfortunate opportunity, a misplaced opportunity to say, see, they're not doing their job in terms of speaking out against this kind of violence. And I don't think that helps anyone.
John, do you want to add something to that?
I do. I'd like to build on Bill's point. I don't think it's sufficient for the community to make statements after the attacks. Those are helpful. Those are proper. I think what law enforcement, the intelligence community, what they're talking about is we need help from within the community before the attacks. We need parents, spouses, friends, brothers, sisters, if they see something that doesn't look right within their own community, their instinct needs to be to go to the authorities, to help the authorities, to be part of this network of self-policing. And I recognize that it takes work on both sides to bring down these walls of distrust that may exist. It is in their interest to help us find out who might be on the verge. It will prevent us from overreacting. It will prevent these kind of attacks that have been occurring. And I know that the FBI, the local law enforcement, they applaud the kind of cooperation they get. They could use more of it. And one of the things that's come out, something that's been mentioned, are these JTTFs, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces. And this was a response to 9/11 to try to have better coordination between law enforcement, the intelligence community, and between the federal and state authorities. And I've heard from people here that they consider that we have a very good JTTF, and everybody going to those meetings would say the more information they have from people that are within this community, important members of the community, the better we all are.
You know, John, as you were saying that, I was thinking about what Andy Lugar, the U.S. attorney here, is doing. Now, this is a pilot program to do some of what you and Bill are talking about within the community, but it's fairly new, perhaps too new to know whether it's bearing any fruit yet. I don't know if you've heard anything about that.
I have. We're one of those three pilots, as you say, and I know that Andy Lugar is going about it the right way. I don't know whether he's satisfied with the kind of response that we're getting. And I know the reality is if he were not satisfied, I don't think he would say it bluntly on Minnesota Public Radio or in a public setting. That's the kind of information that we want to find out. We'll give it time. You might interview members, imams in the mosque and others to ask them how they're responding to Lugar's message. I think we all agree if we're going to minimize the chances, we've got to work better between law enforcement and the various communities here and in the rest of the United States.
A call here from Merle in Savage. Hi, good morning, Merle. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hi.
It seems to me like there's two issues here. That's the organization, like ISIL, and then there's the individual. But on the speaking to the organizational thing, this organization of ones like them don't manufacture any weapons. They don't manufacture any vehicles. So it seems like the attack on their supply chain is ineffective. And I'm wondering if that's because the players, the arms dealers of the nation states, are untouchable.
Bill, do you have an answer to that?
Well, I mean, I actually think we've been pretty effective in terms of dealing with ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and particularly in Iraq. They've lost an enormous amount of territory, and they're losing a lot in Syria as well. So I think that, I mean, clearly access to arms, they got a lot of access to arms in Iraq that were left behind by the Iraqi army, and that has enabled them to put up a pretty good front against the Iraqi army and the coalition forces who were fighting them. But on the other hand, I think we've been pretty effective in undermining them in both Syria and Iraq. And in terms of sort of a global arms trade, well, that sounds like that's a good topic for another show, Carrie.
Yeah, it does, Bill. A question, though, that kind of follows on that from Jack in Shoreview, who says, where are the attackers getting their funding? And I don't know if he means ISIS at large, probably. Is it coming from abroad?
in Syria.
Some of it is coming from abroad. Some of it was coming from robbing banks. Some of it was coming from selling oil. And actually, part of the strategy now that they had, that they accumulated a lot of cash in Iraq, I think, in particular, but also in Syria, and they stored it. And part of our attack strategy now, our airstrikes, is focused on sort of bombing and eliminating these caches of cash that ISIS has been using to fund itself, and also cutting off the ability to sell oil. The more the Turks became involved with this process, in terms of not allowing that oil to be sold, the more it cut off funding for ISIS. But it does come from abroad as well, from not so much with ISIS, but with Al Qaeda in the past. It's come from various charities that would help fund these organizations.
Bill, just understand this: when you talk about ISIS selling oil, I mean, it, obviously that's going out on the black market. Who's
right.
buying it?
Well, people who need it and want it and can sort of turn their nose up as to where it's coming from are buying it. Clearly, it's not the right thing to do. Clearly, it's something that we need to fight against. But also, obviously, buying cheap oil is something that people are willing to do.
John, Stephen St. Paul heard that news cut, I think, where Donald Trump is saying that the New York police often know who will commit these crimes or these acts of terrorism, Ray, the bombs that they are finding in New York and New Jersey. Trump adds they don't want to appear to be racist by profiling, so they don't go after these people. Give us some the benefit of your thinking on that.
I don't think that that's true. I think that simplifies this matter. I don't think there are any notions that we have racist law enforcement or intelligence agencies, and I don't go to the other extreme to think that they're trying to protect our country only by being politically correct. There's an obvious point that maybe is worth repeating. When we take territory back from ISIS in Syria or Iraq, when we took territory back from Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, that did not end the problem. And many of the experts said that it made the problem more difficult to monitor. They tried to warn the American people that what used to come from these areas will now go underground. The positive side of that is that when you take away their sanctuary, when you take away territory or the central command, it reduces the risk of large scale, of coordinated attacks, of catastrophic attacks. I think, however, it increases the chances of having low-level, more frequent attacks. And we've seen that there was a shift in Al-Qaeda strategy many years ago when we had weakened them in the central command. They put out the message to improvise, and people have improvised based on that playbook. What we see is that the more likely playbook that's grabbed is ISIS, and I see this as a long-term problem. I hope that the attacks are contained or not large. I know that's the same aspiration that they have in France and other places that are dealing with this low-level, inspired type of terrorism that I believe, sadly, is going to be with us for many more years.
So, Bill, it sounds like you and John agree that for as necessary as it is to reclaim this territory, as is going to happen, it sounds like, near Mosul in the next couple of months, this may even raise the threat level higher for the kinds of things we saw over the weekend and whatever is happening in New York and New Jersey.
Well, it certainly changes the dynamic. As I mentioned earlier, ISIS is metastasizing. But the idea of having individual cells, which are more operational, and I'm going to continue to use the word inspirational, the kind of thing that occurred in St. Cloud, which seems at this moment to be inspirational, mm-hmm. or more inspirational, that is occurring, but it has been occurring. It has been occurring for some time. I think the good news is that we're getting a bit more sophisticated in how we approach these sort of attacks, operational and inspirational. But I think John is absolutely right. The more we get them in Syria and Iraq, the more opportunity they have to sort of do these sorts of things overseas, which I guess gets to the question that you were asking, Kerry. It will be a long-term war. It will be a long-term effort, and I think we just need to sort of accept that. But we don't need to accept that there's nothing that we can do. I think there's plenty that we can do, and there's plenty that we're doing. The JTTF that John mentioned is one of the kinds of things that have come out of 9/11 that I think have improved our ability to protect ourselves.
John, are you hearing enough of a robust discussion discussion of this. Bruce Hoffman told us no when it comes to the presidential campaign.
We don't have it as part of the presidential campaign. Bruce Hoffman is part of a robust discussion, but I think that's for elite circles. I'd like to build on another point about what we can do in response. And we sometimes focus on law enforcement and the intelligence community and not enough on the public. You did a program about the five-year anniversary of the attacks on the London transport centers. And those were similar to these recent attacks. They were improvised. They weren't that sophisticated, but they did take lives. They damaged people. What we saw, though, is the British reaction the next day. Mm-hmm. The people went about their business. They took the tube. They took the buses. They understood, having gone through other conflicts, that the way to defeat this in the long term is to not allow it to change our way of life. And in that sense, I'm optimistic. I think the reaction has not been panic in our financial markets. It's not panic in New York City. It's not panic here. People are talking about it, recognizing, sadly, we're going to have more of these attacks, but we can't overreact. We can't simplify. And what we might have is that the American public and your, I won't speak for myself, the people that talk on your program are probably more sophisticated than the politicians in dealing with this long-term problem of terrorism.
It's interesting, John. I thought you were going to say that you heard the program we did about are we basically acknowledging that we have to live with terrorism? That was on the 15th anniversary of 9/11. I think I hear you saying, and we talked about the American response to this and how it's changed since 9/11. I think I hear you saying we are learning to do that, and we're kind of accepting that.
We are learning to do it. You know, I listen to so many of your programs, but I have these classes to teach that sometimes correspond with
classes.
Your program. But I have the podcast, too. Yes.
Okay.
You do. Hey, Carrie, can I just jump in for one second
Yes.
here? I don't want to be political because that's not my role. But I do think Secretary Clinton, I think she's given 5 or 6 speeches on her counterterrorism strategy, and she just had this meeting in New York with people like David Petraeus, who was once the head of the CIA, and I think some others who were involved, Mike Morrell, my old friend and colleague, was there as well from the CIA. So I think she has really focused in both the ISIS threat, the Al-Qaeda threat, the homeland threat, and how we can develop a strategy that will both allow us to play the long game, but to protect ourselves in the interim. One may not agree with everything she says. I happen to, but one may not. But at least she is saying things, and she is making an effort.
Now, I'm hoping, John and Bill, that gets drawn out even more in the debates, where the candidates are, where some of what she's been saying in these speeches that perhaps are not covered as extensively as they should be, gets pulled out and explained. John, can we hope for that?
We can hope for that. And a question that I put to all of your listeners, how would we define victory in this conflict? How many years do we have to go without a major attack, a minor attack? That's the difficulty. I can't come up with a set of factors. I don't know how many years we have to go by. We know that Al-Qaeda was patient about its attacks. It went after the World Trade Center in 1993. 8 years later, it finished its evil job. I don't know that we're going to be able to let our guard down, but I think we feel that we're a little bit safer than we were, that these are not attacks that are connected to nuclear weapons, to biological weapons, to chemical weapons. These are still crude attacks. They kill people. They injure people. It's not the kind of attacks that we worried about right after 9/11. And in that regard, we've made progress, slow progress.
There's a link right now to my conversation with Joby Warrick about his book, Black Flags. You can find that on the live blog. Bill, John, thank you very much. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Carrie.